It's the season of Lent, as I was saying at the beginning, and Lent is a time for new things. So we often associate Lent with giving things up. Maybe you have given something up. I don't know. People sometimes do. But when we do that, I think really we're only doing it, I think probably in fact even we should only really be doing it if we're making room for something. So there's loads of lovely disciplines and things in the church, aren't there, in terms of generosity and fasting and prayer and Bible study and worship and confession and, you know, loads and loads of things that we can do. And if you're giving things up, then do that to make room for something. Don't just give it up for the sake of giving up, if you like, and take on something new. And the Christian faith, of course, is just full of new things. And the Bible is full of new things. And of course, Jesus is the most amazing new thing, above everything else, far above anything else. And Jesus, as someone new, is a bit confusing to people to start with. And so they wonder, well, who's he a bit like? Does that help us? Can we picture Jesus as a new someone else? Would that help us? A new version of someone. And so sometimes people think of Jesus as being like a new Moses or Joshua, for example. So someone who finds his people in captivity and in slavery, and he takes them to a new place, he takes them to freedom, he takes them to the promised land, which in Jesus' case, of course, is eternity and forever with him. That's the place he takes people to. Or they think, well, he's a bit like David, you know, the great king of the Old Testament, but Jesus is a newer and a better and a wiser and a greater king than David. He's like a new one of those. Or maybe he's like a new Abraham who was promised that he would have generation after generation after generation of people. And Jesus is the one from whom come all the generations of people who've known him in the 2,000 years since. So Jesus is like a newer and a better Abraham. And you might have heard people talk about Jesus describing him as a new this or a new that or a new someone or a new someone else. And this bit in Romans 5 that we're looking at today is similar to that, but it talks about Jesus being like a new Adam, really. It doesn't use the language of a new Adam, but it does talk about Adam quite a lot. And I'm aware there's quite a lot of complicated stuff in there, and I just want us to sit together and to think together for a little bit and try and help ourselves through this tricky bit from Romans 5, 12 to 19, which is sort of on that right-hand column on page 1132. And Paul begins straight away talking about sin and talking about death and talking about what's come into the world through one man and what comes into the world through the other. And so Paul is sort of comparing Jesus and Adam, and he's asking the question, well, what is different? Because it's interesting, isn't it, to notice when we talk about Jesus being like Moses and Joshua and Abraham, we're talking about the good stuff that they did. Jesus is like a new one of them, but kind of better. And when we talk about Jesus being like Adam and a new Adam, it's a bit different, because, you know, we connect Adam with negative things, with the sin and the fall. And so Jesus is like a sort of a replacement for Adam, but he's like the Adam from the beginning, you know, the new man, the new perfect creation, from whom we're all sort of descended and to whom we're all connected to God. And so Jesus Paul at least is saying in this passage, Jesus isn't like the fallen Adam, the Adam who's sinned and has gone astray. When I ask people, why is Jesus not like Adam? I ask Christians, oh, there's always someone who says something like, well, you get more points in Scrabble for Jesus than Adam. So I've put them up so that we can see that, yes, in fact, we do get more points for one than the other. But there's some more meaningful differences than that, which we're going to have a look at now. And we're going to have a look at them, thinking about them both being one man, one Jesus and one Adam. And then we're going to think about what that one man and that one man's actions have to do with all of us. We're like the many. It talks in the reading about the many. So there's the one and the many. So we're going to think about Adam, the one and the many, and then Jesus, the one and the many. This is a bit small, so I'll tell you what it says. The first one, Adam, it says Adam is one man who brought sin and who brought disobedience. So what Adam did was sin and disobedience. And what that means, or here, is basically he didn't do what God said, did he? So it says, you know, you can eat any of the trees, you can eat fruit from any of the trees, but just that one, you mustn't eat. And then Adam and Eve did eat from that one tree, and that was the moment when sin came into the world, the Genesis story tells us, and that was like disobedience, like not doing what God asked them to do. And Paul says that one man's sin and disobedience brought sin and disobedience to the many. So Paul is saying now, you know, we're like the many. And so because Adam sinned, or we're marked by Adam's sin, but also in our turn, we all sin. So it's not like saying, well, I do it because, you know, it's all Adam's fault. It might be nice to say that. But it's not quite like that, because in our turn, each of us do as well. And Paul says, and he's going back to the Genesis story where it's really clear there, Paul says that what comes of sin and disobedience for Adam is this same thing, is sin and death and condemnation. And you can see that that's what Paul is saying, because it's there in the passage. So right at the beginning, sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all men because all sin. So that's the bit that says it's not just because Adam did it, it's because we all do it. And so that's what happens here. The sin and the disobedience of one lead to sin and death and condemnation for many. So we get sort of stuck in this predicament, in this real problem. Because we don't want, you and I don't think, to be in this position here where we are trapped just by, you know, the things that we do, where we're trapped by the reality of sin in the world, where we're trapped by death, knowing, you know, that that's the one thing ultimately that we can be certain of that comes to everyone, and golly, what does that mean, and what am I going to do about it? That we can be trapped by condemnation. Condemnation is what they say when you crash a car, writing it off. Condemnation is like being written off, isn't it? You know, well, that's him done with, that's her done with. You won't ever amount to anything. You're not very good. You're not. All those voices that we hear, that is a consequence of all of this stuff that is in the world, and because of that, but because of Adam who sins. And this is really very, it's kind of well known in terms of Christian thought, this sort of movement and this idea. And if I'm honest, and it led me to a good time for thinking through and chewing things over and processing stuff, isn't it? And if I'm honest, I'm aware of the pull that is on me still towards these things and towards stuff that doesn't bring life, but brings death and brings condemnation. And I'm always wanting to pray and to ask God to help me. And of course he has helped me, because as Adam came as one man, Paul says, Jesus comes as one man. So there's judgment because of the one sin that leads to condemnation, not just for one, but for many. But then there's also Jesus, who has the same, you know, human body as Adam, if you like. He's the same, he's a man just like Adam is. Adam only really means man. Jesus is a man like Adam is a man. But Jesus lives an amazing, amazing, amazing life. And Jesus' life, where Adam's was characterized by his sin and his disobedience, and mine is in some respects, Jesus' life is characterized by his grace and his righteousness and his obedience. So someone called Karl Barth, one of the most famous writers about God in the whole of the last 100 years, he wrote a big bit about Jesus, and he called it the obedience of the Son of God. Because he saw that it was really important that Jesus obeyed God where Adam had disobeyed. And that in obeying God, Jesus was undoing Adam's disobedience. So just as one man's disobedience had consequences, so one man's obedience has consequences. Just as one man's sin had consequences, one man's righteousness, which means living completely rightly with God, with no sin or rebellion or anything like that. So one man's righteousness has consequences, and it brings this amazing grace and righteousness and obedience for all of us, which is the next thing. Because we receive grace through Jesus' grace. Grace is our English word, and the original word where it says grace in the Bible, the Greek word is a word that's just, it means sort of a gift, really, a gift. So grace is something that we can't earn ourselves, that we can't get for ourselves, but it's something that Jesus gives us. And it's just the same with these other things. We can't earn life for ourselves. We can't earn eternal life for ourselves. But Jesus can earn life for us through his righteousness and his obedience. And we can't have, and justification and righteousness really are the same word here. We can't have those two things which are one thing. We can't be justified before God, as in we can't stand in front of God and say we've never got anything wrong, basically, is what it means. But because Jesus can, because he can say, God, I completely obeyed you. God, I am completely right with you. So we can be completely right before God because of what Jesus has done for us. And that is grace. That is God giving us what we don't deserve. When I was, Catherine and I just had Grace, and Grace was very small. She was probably a week old, or even less than a week. I can't remember, she might have been 10 days old or something. It's funny how one remembers things are on a Friday sometimes, don't you? That's sort of Friday. We went to the hospital because of Grace's arm. We had to have her heart scanned, because sometimes those things are connected with problems with the heart and things. And we went into the hospital, and the regional expert on little baby hearts had come over, and he did a scan to make sure that it all looked okay. And he said, yes, it was fine. We thought it would be fine because they'd done one in the womb. Amazing what they can do. It's crazy, isn't it? And they said, oh no, that does look fine, and it was, and that was great. We came out of this appointment with this consultant, and we were just leaving, and we stopped at the reception desk on the way out, and they were it's tiny, because it was like the paediatric department, and not most babies we came through, or most children come through a bit bigger than Grace was. And he said, yes, he is. And the lady behind the desk said, oh, what's her name? And we said, oh, her name's Grace. And the lady said, and some of you have heard this before, I know, the lady behind the desk said, oh, someone wants to tell me that's for God's riches at Christ's expense. And we said, yes, that's why we called her that. That's what we think too. It is that, isn't it, here, what we see. It's God's riches, his righteousness, Jesus' obedience, which come to us at Jesus' cost. So it's on the cross, as Jesus dies, that he wins for us this grace and life and justification and righteousness that we couldn't do for ourselves. Just as Jesus' grace and righteousness and obedience, they sort of undo Adam's sin and disobedience, so we have this amazing justification and righteousness where we had condemnation before. So if you belong to Jesus, you can never be told that you don't. You can never be told that you're not loved or forgiven or accepted or welcomed or made whole, or however you might describe it. You can't ever be told that you're not those things, because Jesus has put all of his righteousness on you and all of this condemnation has gone away. If you belong to Jesus, you can't ever be told that you don't have life, not just now but forever, because we have this life which conquers death. Not because we can find a way to do that, you know, they'd love to find a way to make people live forever. It's all the stuff of sci-fi films and books and what have you. Or cryogenic suspension. But Jesus can. Jesus' life wins over our death. And we can't deal ourselves, we can't make our bad stuff go away. But Jesus can. His grace can wash away our sin. His life beats our death. His justification and righteousness beats our condemnation. It wins. We have won. Now, yesterday there was a football match, and yesterday Norwich played Sheffield Wednesday, and Norwich did very well, and they got a goal, which was very clever of them. But Sheffield Wednesday got five goals, which was excellent. And so we won, you see, because we got five goals, and we beat Norwich because they only got the one. Are you following me? Yeah. Is clear, the five and the one. Have you got that bit? Can I move on now? We got five goals, and Norwich, they just got the one. I expect they'll beat us next time, but yesterday we won. Now let me tell you what I did yesterday. Yesterday I went off with the family, went over to Cambridge to do something that Jonathan wanted to do, because it's going to be his birthday soon, and I suppose we got in the car around about the time that the match was starting, so we were in the car sort of pretty much the whole way through the match, and then we got home and we followed the last little bit just on the telly. So I didn't actually contribute meaningfully to Sheffield Wednesday winning yesterday. This might surprise you, didn't it? But I didn't. I didn't actually do anything, and yet here I am saying that we won. It's interesting, that's what we do, isn't it? We won. What did you do? Just sat at home and watched it on the telly. but we won. And it's the same thing here, that this business of the many and the one. Because one person won, the many win. Because one person had grace, the many received grace. Because one person was full of righteousness, the many received righteousness. Because one person was obedient, we won, who it is, the many received justification. Do you see that? Do you see how what is true of the one, Jesus, becomes true of the many? That we win, not because of what we've done, but because of what Jesus has done. And so Jesus, the new Adam, is better than Adam. And if you think about Adam, I was actually talking to someone after this about this after the service at Caister. It was really interesting. And we were reflecting how Jesus takes us back to the sort of state of Adam before it all went wrong, doesn't he? That kind of restored relationship with God, which is forever. Actually, Jesus is better than Adam, so he always takes us further and beyond where Adam could have taken us. But Jesus is the new Adam in that sense. He takes us to the place, takes us where Adam could have taken us but didn't, and takes us beyond that. And we have this grace and life and justification and righteousness because of him. So one little thought just to finish with, and then perhaps you might like to talk to someone for a moment. It reaches just a question about where we are, you know, or how where we feel that we are. And down here,
in this box, as I was saying before, is the place where the many who have come to know Jesus belong. And so I wonder if we feel today that we have received grace and life and justification and righteousness. I wonder what it means to us that we have. I wonder which of those words jumps out at us and makes us say, yes, I thank you, God, for what you've done for me. And as we think about those words, we might like to reflect that the reality of being without Jesus is that we're not over here, but that we're over here. And that there are those who don't know Jesus, but their experience of life is not of what Jesus can do, but of being in Adam and this sin and death and condemnation that that brings. So how does that make us feel, knowing that there are people who don't know this yet, who get stuck around here somewhere, who haven't heard enough or sort of received enough about Jesus, believed enough about Jesus, that they realise and believe and accept that this is for them? You know, what does it mean that there are people here, and how does that make us feel? How does it make us pray? What does it make us do? So two sets of questions, really. One that you can talk to each other about now for a minute. One to do with this grace and life and justification and righteousness. What does it all mean to us? And another one about this area of Adam and sin and death and condemnation. What does it mean that there are people in that position? How does that make us feel? How does it help us to pray? What does it? Yeah. That's what's up. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay? Yeah. So why don't you talk to one another for 5 minutes, and then we should be ready for the children coming back and to move forward with the service a little bit. I'll leave that up on the screen in case it's helpful. Thank you.